Ever wonder what happens before a Next Fan Up podcast? Wonder no longer. That was 4 minutes of rambling. All right, let's start over.
Thank you. Oh, fish.
Right. That should be the intro. Ah, fish.
Sorry, I've been streaming my garden for the last hour and a bit, and I'm absolutely knackered. And I had my beautiful wife brought home a takeaway, so I'm just about falling asleep, and I'm sore all over.
And Neil, literally nobody here understands a word you just said.
Thank you, Justin. I was totally lost. He lost me at garden.
Oh, streaming is when you have this machine which cuts the very thick grass and branches. It's kind of like a long pole with a thing swirling around at the end with an engine on it. Anyway, enough to say. I've been gardening and I'm knackered.
Right, and what does that mean? What is knackered?
Oh, I'm very tired.
Oh.
Wait, I thought knackered was drunk.
God.
No, knackered's very tired. Or you could say cream crackered.
Can we start the show now? Can we just?
Oh, okay. I thought this was the show. So is it true? I guess like Scottish people love lawns. Is that a thing?
Golf courses.
Oh yeah, yeah. Just keep your feet off my lawn.
Wow.
Listen. We go out, we hit people in the mouth.
You play to win the game.
Next Fan Up.
I want winners.
Featuring Pod Vader and the Superfans.
They are who we thought they were.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition. I used exciting again, but hey, it's because this is the second time around of the Next Fan Up podcast. I am Pod Vader. I'm joined by our Thursday regulars. I've got Greg, who's over there in Pittsburgh. Hello, Greg. How are you?
Doing great.
Guess you're not really in Pittsburgh, but you're our Steelers super fan. So hopefully people understood what I was trying to say there. Because Neil is our Washington super fan. And as you heard, he's not in Washington. He's in Scotland. But he is our Redskins super fan. Hello, Neil.
Good evening, men. The off season's over. Football is about to start. Let's get going. Let's get serious.
We do have a game to talk about coming up on this Sunday. Exciting. It's our first game, one of many, all the way into 2017. Justin is our Seattle superfan, who is actually in the state of Washington. Hello, Justin.
Hello, fellas. Yes, I'm actually in Washington, which means it's still the morning here. So as Neil would say, I'm a bit knackered.
Everyone just heard Neil say knackered. So, I'm glad that we've given everyone a good vocabulary to work on. I should have said this was the knackered edition of the Next Fan Up podcast, but I wouldn't want people to turn this off. Speaking of turning people off, I want to make sure that you're emailing us nextfanup@gmail.com. Like Justin's friend, Jared, emailed us. But Justin, your friend Jared wants us to talk about kickers. Who's the best punter in the league currently, and what determines the best punter? I don't think we're going to get into that here. Not today.
I think it was mainly an excuse to send you a bunch of pictures of John Ryan making terrible faces when he's doing his job. But hey, two emails in, I think that gets him official friend of the show status.
Oh, now we're just handing out friends of show. This is interesting.
Good thing he sent visual aids for an audio podcast.
Always a good point made by Greg. We also want you to tweet us at NFU Podcast. And of course, you're going to want to check out our Facebook pages. As I mentioned, we do have a game coming up this Sunday. That means we have super fan previews, and we'll be getting to that a little bit later on in today's show. I did want to share one other place where you can interact with us, and that is on iTunes, where, of course, you can leave us a review, much like Irish RT did way back in June, but we didn't read his review on this podcast. Irish RT says, "This is a must listen. I've known Pod since his days at ESPN. Always an entertaining guy. This is a must listen for all the fans." Well, thank you, Irish RT. We are by the fans for the fans. So please do tell all of your buddies about the show. Share it with them. We are heard wherever great podcasts are found. Let's jump into the news here before we get to our guest, maybe dive a little bit into the Hall of Fame inductions coming up. And then, as I mentioned, we do have a game. I'm putting game in quotes, by the way. It's not really a game, but we do have a game coming up this Sunday that we get to talk about. So the biggest news today, as we are in Thursday, is that Nick Foles ended up getting released from the Los Angeles Rams of Anaheim, and he got signed by the Kansas City Chiefs. Now, the Dallas Cowboys were looking for a backup quarterback, and Neil, since you're in their division, I'm going to start with you. Nick Foles with the Chiefs, a good backup for them for sure, but no backup for the Dallas Cowboys, who lost Kellen Moore with a broken bone.
Yeah, the blow for Kellen Moore, of course, broken leg. But it's a really weird one, Jay. Why are Dallas not just getting out there and signing the guy? I mean, it seemed a bit of a no brainer, really, to think, yeah, Foles to Cowboys makes perfect sense. Foles to the Chiefs, maybe not so much sense. But what are Dallas going to do when Romo, his shoulder crumples again after a couple of games this season? They're going to turn to Dak Prescott. Who knows? Maybe they're seeing somebody out there that they can pick up later. But they're certainly leaving it. They're cutting it fine. And then to add to that, I think didn't their young rookie running back Elliott, didn't he get a hamstring injury? Yesterday or the day before.
He did. So the chosen one, not the anointed great one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Greg, your thoughts here. Nick Foles.
I think the Chiefs just wanted to make sure that everyone there appreciated Alex Smith. And that's the only reason they signed him.
Justin, you have any thoughts here on Nick Foles?
Yeah, I guess the Chiefs just had a bunch of money laying around and couldn't think of any players of their own to give it to, so they decided to give it to Nick Foles.
Are you taking a shot at the fact that they did not come to terms with Eric Berry, perhaps?
I think their priorities are a little bit screwed up on this one, Jay.
It will be interesting. Agreed. You know, as I was searching through headlines, I did see an article on ESPN that mentioned, you know, with the Nick Foles signing, we'll see just how much the Chiefs do appreciate their quarterback in Alex Smith. As it's been stated here before, I'm a big Alex Smith supporter. I would love to have Alex Smith if I didn't have Tom Brady. I don't understand the Alex Smith hate, quite honestly.
The Alex Smith hate's easy to understand. He's a smart guy who can't really play effective passing game football. I mean, that's why he's wasting Jeremy Maclin right now. I mean, I wish the Patriots had Alex Smith. That'd be amazing. So, and I know I'm alone on that in this podcast, but...
Yeah, I'm an Alex Smith fan. I also I'm also an Aaron Murray fan, and I wonder what they'll do now with four quarterbacks. I'm not sure if Nick our Chiefs fan, super fan, left any message there about whether Tyler Bray would go or whether Aaron Murray would go, or if they would keep all four of the quarterbacks. But well, interesting move for them.
Well, funny that you bring up Nick. He says, I'm really not sure if it would be Bray or Murray. Murray's a better scheme fit. Bray has the higher upside. Fans are split on the two. I guess I'd prefer to keep Bray as a project. I'm not sure how soon they have to make a move on them, but the fact that they brought in Foles shows that they don't have faith that either would be a good option to start in a pinch this season. So there you go. The perception of the Chiefs superfan, that's Nick. You can hear him on Sundays on the Next Fan Up podcast. So I'm sure he'll be talking about Nick Foles coming up this Sunday. The Giants also added a big free agent. This is a guy that I was surprised was out there for as long as he was, and that's Leon Hall. So the Giants secondary just got a little bit better, Neil.
Yeah, the Giants' secondary got a little bit better, but it's all relative. Their secondary is bloody awful. He'll help. Good experienced player and might help bring along some of the younger players they have. But if I was a Giants fan, I would be worrying about that secondary.
Greg, thoughts on Leon Hall?
Well, I mean, I think he's a good heady veteran to have for your slot or something, but he's definitely past his prime. I mean, I think he's 31 or 32. He's, in my opinion, a shell of the athlete he used to be. I'm sure the knowledge of the game gives him an advantage, but I think this is just a pure depth move for them.
They definitely got a lot at the cornerback position. I think that there's value there having good depth, but at a certain point, if you have a whole lot of guys who are kind of meh, I don't know that they've improved their team a whole lot other than adding depth. I mean, I don't know what the numbers were, but if instead of spending money on him, they could have put some money into a pass rusher like Dwight Freeney before he signed or something. I think that would have made a much bigger difference in how they perform on passing downs. So I guess, depth is always good, but I just don't see a whole lot of need here. And I don't see that this makes them much better than they already were, especially after already spending a bunch of money this offseason there.
Neil, did you hear that? At 31, he's past his prime. I guess we're out to pasture at this point.
Yeah, I think that ship sailed for me, Jay, certainly.
Where a ship didn't sail, and I'm also surprised on this signing, the 49ers signed Navarro Bowman to a long extension there, Justin. So you're going to have to deal with him for a few more years.
Yeah, this one surprises me, mainly because it's an extension, but it's not like he's in the last year or two of his deal. He still had 3 years to go, and then they also signed him I think it was 4 years to go and then a three-year extension, or vice versa. Long story short, they now have him on a seven-year deal, which is kind of crazy to me. I'm sure there's out clauses after specific years and things like that, but you have a terrific linebacker, one of the best in the NFL if he's back to being healthy, set for a seven-year deal. And I don't know that linebacker is a position that you really want to bet on being incredibly effective for the better part of a decade in the future, not with the kind of beating wear and tear an inside linebacker takes. So really good player, but this one's kind of a head scratcher to me. I guess in the month and a half Chip Kelly's been there, he's fallen in love with him.
Well, he's the leader of that team, and was the leader of that team for quite a few years, Greg.
Yeah, and he is a good player when he is fully healthy. I just wonder, my Steelers like to do this sometimes when they have an aging veteran that has a big proration on their cap. Sometimes when they extend them prematurely like this, all they really do is end up is lowering the cap number and pushing the bonuses further into the future and maybe keeping a flat salary for those end of the year. So I haven't seen the details of the contract other than I saw the headline of $40 million. But his cap hit this year is almost $10 million. So I'd be interested to see what the cap hit, what happened to the cap hit this year and next year to really evaluate the deal properly.
One other extension in the NFL, Tyrann Mathieu finally came to an agreement with the Cardinals. I'm not surprised that he came to an agreement. I guess I'm surprised at the timing of it, considering he is coming off a major injury, Neil.
Yeah, they must be sure that he's going to return to full fitness, and not only full fitness, but also the ferocious play that he shows on the field. With that fantastic energy that I'm sure we'd all love in our defensive backfield, and also his flexibility and versatility, he was an outstanding player. So they must be confident. It's interesting that he plays in the same defensive backfield as Patrick Peterson, and Peterson, of course, is always spoken of in the top two or three corners in the league, top two or three corners in the game at the moment, and yet Mathieu is the sort of face of that franchise. Just shows you the sort of personality he has, and the immense impact he has on the defense. Great, great player. I think Justin mentioned on Sunday in the podcast how good these sort of hybrid players can be on your defense and can make such a huge impact all over the defense. And they'll be hoping that that he can get back to his best. Great, great player.
This was a really interesting one to me. I think that it's almost the ACL injury recovery has become so routine that teams don't even worry about it so much anymore, which is just really so different from the way it was a few years ago. His deal was interesting, though, because if you guys recall back a few years ago, when Jimmy Graham was up for a deal with the Saints, he was basically trying to argue he should get wide receiver money because he lined up on the outside as a wide receiver a lot of the time. Ultimately, they kind of hit a middle ground after going through a little bit of arbitration. Tyrann Mathieu was in a similar boat. He was on the depth chart as a safety, but he played corner 60% of the time. So he could make a case under the letter of the law that he was a corner, and the corner market is a lot higher than the safety market. So they ended up kind of splitting the difference with him, giving him a really good deal. But I think they got a great player out of it. He's still young. He's still ascending. I'm not super worried about the injury, even though it's his second ACL. I think he's honestly just one of the better overall defensive players in the league. And they signed him to an extension that's going to look really, really good 2-3 years from now when the cap has gone up by $20-30 million.
It's really interesting that we spend a lot of time on this podcast, and you hear it all over the media of the players who are suspended and the bad news stories of the guys who just don't work out. And like Randy Gregory, we heard recently with suspension. Mathieu was one of those players. You know, he came out of calling. He dropped to the fourth round, possibly, because of off-field issues and just not being able to get himself on track. And here he is, got himself on track, and he's become one of the biggest players on one of the best teams in the league. It's a really good feel-good story for youngsters getting into the game.
Yeah, it is a good story, that is for sure. And we can only hope that it's a story that gets repeated by players as they continue to enter the league. We mentioned Ezekiel Elliott's hamstring injury a little bit earlier, and I did joke that he's the anointed one, as I've seen him mainly in fantasy go as high as the third overall pick in certain drafts, which I had mentioned to Christopher Harris was absolutely crazy. And if you missed my interview with Christopher Harris, you can go back and listen to our show on that iTunes there that I mentioned earlier in the podcast. But Alshon Jeffrey also still suffering from injuries. He too has a hamstring injury that's been bothering him at camp. Not a good sign here for the Chicago Bears, Greg.
Yeah, losing him, that would really pretty much kill their offensive potency because you don't know what you have in Kevin White still. But I got to think, so the one thought while you were reading that I had was, is this really a hamstring injury? Because he's had his standoff with the front office this year. And I'd love to know what our Bears superfan thinks of it. But, you know, sometimes this might be a veteran move where he's just milking it so he doesn't have to practice.
The funny thing to me with him is I know one of the issues the team has with him is he always seems to be a little nicked up, a little banged up. And so if this does factor into the contract at all, it's just sort of another knock against them from their perspective, I believe. So it'll be kind of interesting to see how that plays out, because I agree with Greg. I think that there's some kind of underlying factor with the larger contract at play here. In addition, you know, in regards to Zeke Elliott, you know, when we were doing our all division teams, which you can find on facebook.com/nextfanup, you know, there was a lot of discussion about who the best NFC East running back was. And a lot of people were pushing for Zeke Elliott, which I thought was the craziest thing I've ever heard, because he's never played a single snap in the NFL. I mean, I feel like all the time we have these players who come in as kind of the anointed ones, you know, these top picks who, you know, until we see them in the NFL, we don't know. And a lot of times they don't pan out. I mean, you know, I look at Zeke Elliott and everything I see, everything I hear sounds really, really great about what he can do, what he could be. His situation is really nice. But, you know, pretty much every analyst said that Trent Richardson was like the next great once in a generation running back. I remember hearing the same thing when my Seahawks drafted Aaron Curry. You know, he was the can't miss, unbeatable, most incredible linebacker prospect we've seen since, you know, the early 2000s. So, you know, hopefully this is just a minor thing and he misses a little bit of the preseason. But anybody who thinks because he's such a ballyhooed prospect coming out of college that he's just automatically going to be a great, great player does not pay attention to the NFL.
You know, Justin, I saw here that you wanted to revisit the Cowboys again and the Randy Gregory suspension that Neil mentioned as news came out about Purple Drank involved with Randy Gregory. You know, the Cowboys seem to be the team that's had a horrible offseason. They also seem to be the team with the fans that are most misguided. As I saw a map of the United States as to where people thought, you know, who had the best chances of winning the Super Bowl this year. And literally, Texas was the only place that had the Cowboys listed as the team with the best chance to winning the Super Bowl. So once again, high expectations, and the Cowboys are coming up, just a little bit short.
You know, Jay, it could have been worse. They could have had the Texans to win the Super Bowl in Texas. So they're not crazy.
Wow. All right. Let's get to our guest. I'm really excited about this one. It's Stadiums USA President Mark Madorin. We're going to be talking about, stadiums. So here we go. It's my pleasure now to bring in our very special guest. He is the president of Stadiums USA. You can find all of their great content at stadiumusa.com. They have a radio show that's available across the United States. And of course, it's a podcast, and you can get the podcast anywhere great podcasts are heard. It's my pleasure to introduce you now to Mark Madorin. Hello, Mark. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Well, thanks for having me. Fun to be here.
You know, this week is all about the Hall of Fame, and as I was going through potential guests, I was like, who better to have than the guys that do nothing but talk about the history of the buildings that games are played in. Tell us a little bit about what you guys have going on over there at Stadiums USA before we jump into the Hall of Fame conversation.
Sure. Stadiums USA is designed to focus on the icons of sports in regard to the venues, the facilities, the famous facilities that house all the stories that occur. We love vintage stadiums. We love stadiums that are new. We like to talk about the plans for people building new stadiums. And our website reflects all of that. We have every sports venue in the United States, from small college up through pros, in multiple sports, NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, and NASCAR, horse racing, tennis. If you got a venue around, we probably have it listed. The only thing we probably don't have is your high school stadium down the street. Other than that, everything should be there. And we've got a little write-up on each facility. We try to pick up the capacities, the year they were built, the architects, and any interesting history that might occur in those venues. And there's a lot of great sports history that we can think of regarding what happened, but we have to remember they all happened in one of these facilities. So it's an interesting site, and one which we think most people enjoy visiting.
You know, you mentioned except for those high school stadiums down the street, and yet the game that will be played this weekend, the first NFL preseason game, will be played at Fawcett Stadium, which does in fact host some various local high schools, which, by the way, I was unaware of. I always wondered, what does the Hall of Fame do with that football field every day, since they only play one game there a year? It's always surprising to me. But the other thing that's always been a surprise to me about that particular field is, to me, it seems like it's the only field in the United States that has high school, college, and pro football hash marks on it.
It is. It is the only stadium that we think exists that there's an NFL game, a college game, and a high school game, at least one of every one of those every year. And there aren't any facilities like that in the country. Most of the time, college and pros can share, but usually the high school kids don't get on there unless it's one game as a special city championship or state championship or something. Most of the time, the facilities are not shared at all three levels. So this is an unusual facility.
You know, there's some changes afoot with the Hall of Fame. I know I've read some articles that Tom Benson, the owner of the Saints, gave a fairly large donation, and the Hall of Fame has some plans for changing that. Do you know a little bit about that, and can you tell us about some of those changes?
I do. Tom Benson actually went into his piggy bank, and I think he donated $11 million, which for Tom Benson probably was in his cup holder in the car or something. But the $11 million, they're going to rename the field for him. I don't know who Mr. Fawcett was. I believe he was a local high school administrator of some kind, but his name is being removed and Mr. Benson's will be added to the field. They have reconstructed the field in such a way as to add HD video boards at each end, and they've made the bleachers different so that they have a stage built into the center of the bleachers on one side, and then the stands kind of swing around. So it's as much a concert facility as it is right now a sports facility. So it's a very interesting change.
And I imagine that's going to be done so it can be a stream of revenue for the Hall of Fame.
The Hall of Fame is looking at creating a totally unique type of atmosphere around the hall. They're doing what a lot of Major League Baseball teams are doing. As an example, the St. Louis Cardinals built the Ballpark Village across the street from the new Busch Stadium. And that has restaurants and shops and other places for fans to go, whether there's a game in progress or not. And it's a great facility. I've been down there, and it's a wonderful concept. The Hall of Fame is doing the same thing. They're going to be putting in a Hall of Fame village around the Hall of Fame, which is going to include shops and offices. And their plans are for a football-themed hotel that will have something about 250 rooms, and they'll have the Brett Favre ballroom and the Joe Namath Entertainment Center and all that kind of stuff in the hotel. So the whole concept is to draw revenue. And of course, induction weekend, they have a big crowd. But the rest of the year, the crowds are kind of sparse. And I think they want to kind of beef that up with some new entertainment options through the stadium and through this use of the Hall of Fame Village.
Well, it'll certainly make Canton, Ohio a little bit more of a destination, that's for sure. By the way, another important note that I want to just remind our listeners, it is the Pro Football Hall of Fame. It is not the NFL Hall of Fame. Although how many non-NFL players are really in the Hall of Fame?
I wonder about that myself. I suppose there could be some from... There have been leagues in the past that weren't NFL, you know, the AFL before they merged. There may be some players or coaches from that or even owners from that could be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And, you know, possibly maybe there's some history of pro football before the NFL was established in 1920, a little before my time, but...
I think it's a little before all of our times.
Yeah, but I know there was football then. And
there we go.
Let's
talk about something that's definitely in our times, and that's a new stadium in Minnesota. Tell us a little bit about that opening that just recently happened.
Oh, U.S. Bank Stadium. This place is amazing. They took down the old Metrodome. I was happy to push the plunger and see that gone. But the new stadium is a unique and memorable facility. It has an open roof that's made of a special glass material, glass-like material. So it's very, very bright inside. If you ever were in the Metrodome, it was like kind of like being in a cave with a flashlight watching a football game. It wasn't real bright inside. This facility is just the opposite. It has the whole feeling of the outdoors and the downtown that you can see through the roof. It will open at one end. It has a very nice capacity. I think it's just going to be an amazing facility, and I think the Vikings are going to be very pleased to be in there. And, of course, they get themselves out of the weather, which the last couple of years they've had to play outdoors. And, Minnesota in December and January is no fun for anyone.
No, and I'm sure Teddy Bridgewater is going to be looking very much forward to throwing inside than outside. Speaking of new stadiums, we now have a team back in Los Angeles. So they're underway with their stadium building. What do you know about what the plans are for Los Angeles?
Oh, Los Angeles is another one of those stadium complexes. Stan Kroenke, who is building a $2 billion stadium, Again, that $2 billion from his cup holder, because Stan Kroenke doesn't really worry about $2 billion the way the rest of us would. But his facility is going to be, again, an amazing facility built on the old Hollywood racetrack, the horse racing track. They have some 200-some acres that are being built around the stadium, and it's going to be a complete complex of office, retail, condos, restaurants, hotels, park-like facilities. There's going to be an arena built on the facility. There's going to be some kind of theater facility built into it. It's going to be an open facility, but with a roof. I don't think it's going to have a lot of sidewalls. So you'll get some feeling of being outdoors, but it will be a covered facility in some way. They're doing the groundwork on it now, and it appears like it's going to be ready in time for their opening in a couple of years. And I think it's great to have the Rams back in L.A. And, of course, they're back at the old Coliseum where they played many, many years ago. And so it's an interesting trip. But the Kroenke facility in Inglewood is an amazing thing. And I think in 5 to 10 years, you'll see that that facility is going to be probably the star in the NFL's venue cap. It's going to be a real great facility. Whereas AT&T is probably their star facility now. I think this one will easily surpass that.
Wow. One other place that's been in the news recently about possible NFL, I don't want to call it expansion, but a new city for the NFL to be in, and one that the NFL has a long history with in terms of avoidance, and that would be Las Vegas. What have you been hearing about a Las Vegas stadium?
Well, the first trick is whether the Raiders can figure out how to get all this done financially. They've tried to work in Oakland and see if they could make something happen, but it just doesn't seem like there's any consensus of getting that done. What's your feeling about them remaining in Oakland first? You think that'll happen?
I mean, I think the NFL would prefer it to happen there just based on, you know, the way that the whole Los Angeles situation ended up shaking out. But I'm in agreement with you. I think getting a new stadium in California, unless I'd be also curious to know, you know, your feelings on San Diego, sort of, you know, what's going on there. I do think that the Raiders are going to end up moving. And if any team is going to be related to Las Vegas, I think the Raiders are sort of the perfect fit.
I would think the Raiders would be the best fit for Las Vegas. It just, the way the Raiders are run with the Davises, and it just seems like it works for Las Vegas. But I think years ago that Las Vegas had a stigma surrounding it that people wouldn't want to put a big name professional team there, one of the four major sports. But the NHL has jumped in, and I think the financial world is a lot different than it was 20, 25 years ago. So I think their concerns about the professional gambling interests in Las Vegas are a non-issue at this point. What's going on in Las Vegas now is they're looking at different sites they could possibly build a domed facility in Las Vegas. And we've talked about that Las Vegas area on our show quite a bit. There were a couple of sites on Tropicana Avenue. If you're familiar with Vegas and the Strip, Tropicana is kind of the one end of the Strip, kind of where MGM Grand is. And there were a couple of decent sites on Tropicana that might have worked. Southwest Airlines objected to the one of them because it was right off the end of the runway. And they said, you know, getting to the airport is going to be a mess if you have 60,000 people trying to get into a stadium at the same time you're trying to service the airport. So that site appears to be out of contention. But there's some other sites that are possible in Las Vegas. And I think knowing the way the business community works in Las Vegas, they could probably come up with the money to build a stadium. And I suspect there would be a great deal of support for it. And they would have no trouble selling seats because what better visiting venue is there for a team to go to than Las Vegas and bring your fans with you? So they could draw really big crowds every weekend. And the facility could probably house UNLV football as well. So I think Las Vegas is a serious consideration, and I wouldn't be surprised if they can figure out how to get the financing done, and find a site. Right now, they're evaluating something like 8 different sites. But I think they'll narrow that list down to 2 or 3 in the next few weeks and seriously pursue the work that it takes to see if those sites would function for a dome stadium.
Mark, what's your favorite stadium? First in the NFL, and then if it's a non-NFL stadium, that too.
Oh, well, I'm a Chicagoan. I grew up in Chicago, but unfortunately, I'm not a Soldier Field fan. I'm certainly not a Green Bay Packer fan, but Lambeau, there's a special feeling about going to Lambeau Field. That's a pretty cool facility. I really love that facility. AT&T for the Dallas Cowboys, again, a magnificent facility. I think it's really incredible. And I think U.S. Bank in Minnesota is going to be one of my favorites. I can't wait to get up there and see it based on the photographs. So I would put all of those in the special category. And other stadiums, as far as what I love, I'm a traditionalist for baseball. You can't help but love the older stadiums. And Fenway Park, there's something special about going to Fenway. Wrigley's being redone, and I think it's much improved. I wasn't a big Wrigley fan 5 years ago, but the modernization has really, really helped. Dodger Stadium in L.A. Is a wonderful place to see a ball game. My favorite one is maybe the new stadium in Pittsburgh, which isn't really new anymore, but it's PNC Park is fabulous. I love sitting there for a ball game. It's just the site, and it's not a really big yard, and it's just well placed in the city. And I just have had such a good time at PNC, and I found the concessions are wonderful, and the food was great. So just the whole fan experience is what we look at when we look at stadiums. It's not just to give you good seat, but what kind of an experience to get going and coming and seeing your favorite team play there. And I think PNC Park is the people in Pittsburgh have it real fortunate that they've got a great facility. And I don't know what other ones you want to go. I love Charlotte Motor Speedway as far as NASCAR, and Daytona as far as NASCAR are two of my favorites. Horse racing, I have some favorites, and indoor arenas. The United Center in Chicago, I do like the way they've done that. And there's some other great facilities for arenas as well. And the arenas are funny because some are shared, you know, NBA, NHL arenas are shared commonly. So I like going to Madison Square Garden just because the history of Madison Square Garden. You know, you're in New York, you're in Manhattan. The energy of that place is very cool. So, but you know, I'm for going to the arena. You're sitting around home watching on TV. You can see the game, but you don't get the same feeling as you are when you're sitting 15 or 20 feet away from the playing surface, and you get a chance to see your favorite players up close and get a sense of the action and the excitement and the passion that goes into professional or college sports or even high school sports. That's great.
Mark, remind our listeners where they can get all your content.
Stadiumsusa.com. You can find us there. It has all the, you can look up your favorite stadium or one you'd like to visit, and also catch our radio show, Stadiums USA Radio, on SB Nation, or you can see the podcast through our website. Go to the radio page and click there, and you can listen to the podcast there. And you'll hear some interesting interviews every week, and we deal with different stadium topics and different people involved in sports just about every week. And it's a fun topic. We've had fun putting it all together.
Mark Bedorin is the president of Stadiums USA. Mark, it's been a pleasure talking to you. I hope to do it again somewhere down the road.
Well, thanks for having me. I love being here, and I appreciate you having us on the air.
All right, so there you go. Mark Bedorin, president of Stadiums USA. And, of course, you can check out those podcasts on iTunes or anywhere great podcasts are heard. That includes blogtalkradio.com. Stadiums USA, check it out. Hall of Fame, as we were talking about there, as I was talking about there with Mark, the inductions are happening this weekend, and thus the Hall of Fame game right after that. So let's talk about this class, this 2016 class. And I'm going to start with the owner or the former owner, or is he still the current owner? I'm not sure. The 49ers owner, Edward DeBartolo Jr. I think this is an induction that's long overdue. And I know I saw Charlie mention, our 49er super fan, that it's a shame that this didn't happen years earlier so that he could be inducted by the great Bill Walsh. You know, DeBartolo Jr., one of those owners that really cared for the players, probably one of the first, you know, player favorite type owners. Let's see here. Justin, you have any thoughts here on Edward DeBartolo Jr.?
This one's a little bit tough because I think most of his impact was when I was a lot younger. So kind of his approach of not being the standoffish executive, but being really involved in the lives of his players is a little more common nowadays. But, you know, Charlie mentioned things like Bryant Young has a son who is sick and Eddie's been supporting him and his family. And I guess that's the sort of thing that he was kind of known for. That engendered a lot of respect and a lot of loyalty from his players. So, you know, something like that, especially if you go back a little bit, you know, further back in football, like the 70s and 80s, when things were very rough, very violent, and the owners were just sort of not very involved with the players. Having somebody kind of change that culture of it is not something that should be lost on us. So is in so much as these types of people in these roles going into the Hall of Fame, I think, yeah, he's probably long overdue.
You know, Greg, you have a team that has a storied owner and they recently made some change. The family made some changes in their front office for the first time in what seems to be, you know, decades with the Steelers.
Yeah. And I mean, the Barlow is a legendary owner when he was owning them. And he's a Youngstown guy, which I've always found interesting that he was never able to or never wanted to own the Browns when Art Modell had them. And what could have been the story of that if, you know, Modell looked to sell them in the 80s. But, yeah, that's pretty much all I want to say.
Neil, you have an owner that... Well, he's pretty infamous.
Yes, Daniel Snyder. Yes, great man, great man. Voice of the people. I think I am old enough to remember Eddie Bartolo in his pomp during the 80s and 90s when he had the San Francisco 49ers. Now, one thing it just tells you just how good the organization was. Do you know, between 1981 and 1998, a period of 17 years, they averaged 13 regular season wins a season. That's the average over that period of time. They were brilliant, and he was the architect behind putting all that together with him with the cash. The reason he has... the reason he's taking a little while for him to get to the Hall of Fame, I think it's the old phrase about time being a great healer. I think he... He went out under a slight cloud, and I probably need to use the word allegedly at some point here in terms of the things that he may have done in that period of time. But he was a character, and he was a, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, these characters were real characters who were fun, and they were crazy, and they were nuts, and they were mad, and they were just brilliant, and you could love them and hate them. And he was one of those guys. I'm sure he was just a fabulous owner if you were one of the players. And he certainly oversaw the funding of some great, great NFL talents line up for that San Francisco team. Yes, overdue, he's there. 5 Super Bowl wins. I'm really happy to see him get in.
You know, it's an interesting thing that you brought up, and I see Greg messaging us about, you know, Edward DeBartolo's legal issues that he's endured over time. It does make for an interesting, like, does his dealings that are less than praiseworthy, should they affect his contributions to the game and for those contributions to be celebrated. I think it sort of brings up the thought of O.J. Simpson, who is a Hall of Famer. I think we have a player next year who's eligible to go in, but probably won't, in Terrell Owens, Ocho Cinco, another one. You know, I'm curious your thoughts on that sort of idea, Greg.
I think that the price he paid, not only by going to jail for some time, but losing the franchise, I think he had to give it to his sister or something, was probably enough. He was open-minded enough to give Bill Walsh a chance with his progressive passing game and to let Bill Walsh do his job. You know, if Jerry Jones had just let Jimmy Johnson do his job for the entirety of the 90s, how many Super Bowls would they have? So I think that is a real talent by him just to put the right people in position and let them do what they are hired to do. So I do respect him for that. And I think he has waited a long time, and he did pay the ultimate price by actually losing his franchise. So
let's move on to someone who definitely doesn't have the off the field issues. Edward DeBartolo Jr. has faced probably the exact opposite of that. And probably what I would say is the main reason why he's in here, that is Coach Tony Dungy. And I think his contributions off the field, not even necessarily as a coach, because honestly, as a coach, does he belong in the Hall of Fame? I say no. Justin?
Well, let's have some historical perspective as well. I think that being the first African-American head coach to win the Super Bowl matters. I think something like that, just for the historical moment of that, certainly helps make his case. And, you know, you can't argue that he wasn't a very, very successful coach and that he's not a Super Bowl
the regulars.
Coach. Yeah. Well, and you know, he's got a ring. And so, you know, those things at the very least, I think get him in the conversation, right? They get him to the table where the voters start talking about him. And then at that point, the historical nature of what he did becomes a factor as well. And so I think that, you know, if you're walking through the Pro Football Hall of Fame, you know, you should be struck by great people, great players, great contributors, and great moments. And, you know, his being the first minority head coach to win the Super Bowl is a great moment and deserves a place in the Hall of Fame. So I think it's absolutely just fine. It's this weird thing, though, where like, the rules on the voting specifically say that you're not factoring in like off the field stuff, but they always do factor in. And I certainly think the fact that Tony Dungy is a notoriously just wonderful human being probably helped his case as well.
Actually, Tom Flores is a minority coach, and he won the Super Bowl before.
You're right. My mistake. The first African American.
There you go.
I think I think you're also underselling Tony Dungy's abilities a little bit here. I mean, he was like the mastermind of a defense that is still being, you know, at least passively played in the NFL today. He was also, a great assistant many along the way. He also was a decent player in his day. I mean, he converted from wide receiver to defensive back for the Steelers in the 70s. I mean, so you're looking at a guy's life that's been intertwined with the NFL, and he's made a lot of great, you know, accomplishments along the way there. So he's definitely worthy. And I would err on the side that there's probably more coaches, especially defensive coordinators and offensive coordinators, that never get the chance to be a Hall of Famer that really deserve it.
That I would totally agree with. I think there's some assistant coaches that will never see the Hall of Fame that absolutely belong there. And I think you had a defensive coordinator that, is one that I would definitely be referring to. Neil, I'm curious your thoughts here on Tony Dungy in the Hall of Fame.
Well, I'll just say right at the start, I don't think he's a Hall of Fame coach. Or if he is a Hall of Fame coach, I think there are at least I can think of two coaches that I would put in there before him. I think if he's going in as the first black coach to win the Super Bowl, then that bodes well for Doug Williams and his chances of getting into the Hall of Fame as the first black quarterback to win the Hall of Fame. And I don't think he should be in the Hall of Fame. And I also don't think that's a reason for putting Dungy in the Hall of Fame either. Not for me. I know he's supposed to be a tremendous guy off the field and all the rest of it, but not for me. I think there's lots of guys who are tremendous off the field. There are lots of great assistant coaches who haven't got into the hall. There are lots of great regular season coaches and other coaches who are not getting into the Hall of Fame. He wouldn't be in there for me. I would put Tom Flores in there. It's a disgrace that Tom Flores is not in the Hall of Fame already. Didn't he win 2 Super Bowls as well? And I would also say that Don Coryell, the ex-San Diego coach, he's a guy that transformed also the passing game before any of these guys that we've got these days, and he should be in the Hall of Fame too, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think you're right. Those guys should be in too. But the last thing I'll say for the case of Tony Dungy is he was able to build a team that was good enough to, when he left, drag Jim Caldwell kicking and screaming to a Super Bowl. That's pretty darn good.
Well, that probably
he also he also built that team that Gruden took to the Super Bowl the year after he left.
Yeah, that's also true. And the last thing I'll say is I do think it helps these guys who get major broadcasting gigs to sort of heighten their overall profile. I'm not saying that's fair or unfair, but I do think that certainly helps. And as I mentioned, I do think a lot of the things that Tony Dungy has done off the field for a lot of players, I know that he was instrumental in bringing Michael Vick back into the NFL, for instance. I think that is a bigger contribution and more Hall of Fame praiseworthy than I think anything that he could have done on a football field. And I will admit that he was a fairly decent head coach during the regular season. During the playoffs, a whole nother story. He managed to get one ring, but that's it. Let's talk about, speaking of one ring, a quarterback who perhaps changed the game a little bit, and that is Brett Favre. Now, out of all the names on this list, we've probably buried the lead here because I think Brett Favre is the highlight of this class. And we'll start with the old timer in Neil for memories of Brett Favre.
Oh, thanks a lot, Jay. Yeah, Brett Favre, I mean, being a Green Bay fan, it must have been just incredible to have a player. He epitomizes that phrase, gunslinger, doesn't he? Which is so beloved over there with you guys. He could throw the ball anywhere, anytime, into any window, and you can be guaranteed that somebody would catch it, whether it was his own player sometimes. And I think he leads the league in interceptions too, doesn't he, and over the history of the game?
I believe so.
Phenomenal player to watch. I mean, exciting. Just entertainment value alone, he was terrific, and it was never say die, was it? He could bring the Packers back from just about anything, and a terrific player, and absolutely worthy of first ballot Hall of Fame. Probably took the guys who make the call there. Probably took them about 5 seconds to say, "Yep, done. Next one." Great player.
I almost feel like there's been a bit of kind of revisionist history on Brett Favre, because I don't think that nowadays when people talk about him, they talk enough about the positives. Because, you know, nowadays when people talk about him, they talk about the risk taker and that he threw a lot of interceptions, which are both totally fair. But, you know, if you go back to the like second half of the 90s, he was the best player in the NFL for about half that decade. I mean, he wasn't just good, and he wasn't just like a top end quarterback. He was hands down the best player in the National Football League, you know, just running off MVPs one after another. I think even the great quarterbacks we see right now, there's not a lot of separation. There was clear separation between Brett Favre and the rest of the NFL for that stretch. And, you know, he was everything that people kind of wanted to see. You know, he was tough. He was gritty. He never missed a game. He clearly loved the game of football. He would make these jaw-dropping throws that are probably ill-advised for 99% of people, but he just had this ridiculous arm that could put him in these tiny spaces. And, you know, every now and then, somebody would pick one off. And then, you know, on the next drive, he would just chuck a couple of bombs and get down there. He had that patented little shovel pass that you see every now and then. For these like a little kind of right over the middle quick hitters. He was so much fun to watch at his prime in his heyday. And I don't think there's really anybody in the NFL right now who plays the quarterback position like he did, which is a shame because, man, he was a lot of fun to watch and such a good player.
I would argue Jay Cutler, but he's way worse than Brett Favre. Greg.
Yeah, that's just disgraceful. You even mentioned Jay Cutler. Jay Cutler's anything but tough. Brett Favre is he's my favorite, I think, quarterback I've ever seen play. Just his story, just his arrogance of, I don't give a crap if there's another defensive back on the field. Like, why would I learn that as a second-year starter? You know, just his blatant arrogance for that we think that football is a thinking man's game and we analyze all these schematics and everything for the game. He just went out there with pretty much brute force and just forced things to happen. It was pretty awesome to watch. I loved it. I mean, in a football game, what do they run, like 20 plays? And they maybe run them like 3-4 times. That's all he did. I mean, he mastered those couple plays and he was amazing at it. I remember on Thanksgiving Day when before he won any Super Bowls or anything, when the Cowboys were the juggernaut, him and Sterling Sharp went across the middle and almost took the referee's head off like 7 times in that game with a stupid little dump down route. And the Cowboys couldn't stop it because the referee kept getting in the way. It was just silly things like that. I just always loved about the guy. I mean, found one thing that worked and he kept beating it to death, and he could do anything that you wanted your quarterback to do. I really appreciate how he played and how tough he was. And just the story of his senior year in college where he played with, you know, 3 years after losing his large intestine or something against Georgia and beat them. I mean, that just stuff is like folklore legend. I mean, he's larger than life when he's on a football field. So I'm a huge fan of his. Despite the fact that there's a former Steeler going in this year, I could care less. I'm just going to be watching Brett Favre's speech and just see what he says.
Speaking of that former Steeler, he was also a former Los Angeles Rams before they were of St. Louis. So Kevin Green being that player, by the way, another Rams player who is of the St. Louis variety, in Orlando Pace also going in this year, but go ahead and talk to us a little bit about Kevin Green, Greg.
Oh, he was awesome. I mean, how many guys in their career get 10 seasons of double digit sacks? I mean, he was just a difference maker for that early 90s Steeler team. He only played 3 years in Pittsburgh, but that's how I identify him. I played much longer with the Rams, but with the Steelers, it was this kind of iconic time for him. That's also when he became a pro wrestler there for a while and everything. So he was larger than life. He had the long hair, looked like a biker. He was pretty awesome. I remember having his jersey back in like sixth grade or whatever. So he was awesome.
And we can't forget his contributions in the wrestling ring in the mid to late 90s as well.
I'm surprised. I mean, he was a guy that I thought would be in the WWE at this point, but no wrestling for him. Interesting.
No, he had a short stint in WCW in the late 90s.
No, I know, but I'm saying I would expect him to still be in there, but he's not, which I think is interesting. Neil, you have any thoughts here on Kevin Green?
Really only just to back up what Greg said. What a tremendous player. Fearsome pass rusher with that consistency that Greg pointed to. Just very, very good player. He was also, wasn't he a defensive coach, more a linebacker coach over recent years? Not sure who with, but I also really don't understand why he's not in the hall already. I mean, he's got 160 career sacks, and that must put him right up there. He must be a top 10 guy in career sacks, I'm not 100% sure, but what a player.
Another guy going in that I failed to mention earlier because he's related to Tony Dungy, and that's the wide receiver Marvin Harrison. I wonder how much Marvin is thanking newly retired Peyton Manning for his position in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, Marvin Harrison was going to go in regardless. I mean, he was an incredibly good football player. I don't think it's necessarily fair to say that he was a product of Peyton Manning. And if I'm not mistaken, he played a couple of years before Peyton Manning and had some really, really nice seasons. Obviously, his career just exploded with him. But he's way, way, way too good a player to be out regardless of who his quarterback was, I think.
I should take that back. I shouldn't claim that his entire career is thanks to Peyton Manning, but I do believe both players, Peyton Manning and Marvin Harrison, benefited from being able to play with each other for as long as they did. I mean, Marvin Harrison, how often is this? I mean, I'm looking at just the current inductees, Brett Favre, Falcons, Packers, Jets, Vikings, Kevin Green, Rams, Steelers, Panthers, 49ers. Marvin Harrison played 13 seasons all with the Indianapolis Colts. That's unheard of at this point, Neil.
Yeah, it's unheard of. I was a little bit taken aback. It's really 5 years since he retired. It doesn't seem that long at all. But yeah, no, a great player. How often do we see the players that we call, the quarterbacks we call great quarterbacks? How often do we have a guy like that, a wide receiver, a really top player who has been with them through the bulk of their career? I think I can think of, obviously, Jerry Rice with Montana and Young. Marino had Duper and Clayton, I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. So I think it's probably quite a common thing. But when that sort of pairing comes together of great quarterback and great wide receiver, can be quite devastating, of course. Very, very good player these days. Reggie Wayne, will he also get into the hall, do you think?
That's a great question.
Oh, he's an automatic, yes.
Yeah, here's the
Harrison or Wayne, who's better?
Harrison.
Harrison, definitely Harrison. But
yeah. I mean, wide receivers are a really hard position to get in. Even Harrison, Harrison actually last played football in 2008. So it's been 8 years, but he had to wait. Even with his incredible accomplishments, he had to wait a couple years just because it's so hard as a wide receiver to get into the Hall of Fame right now. I think Reggie Wayne, just in a vacuum, is a Hall of Famer. But you know, you have to think, if five players go in every year, you know, who's he beating out every year for that spot? That's really, really difficult. If Reggie Wayne does go in, it's probably going to take a little bit of luck versus who's on the ballot, and probably going to take him a few tries, not because he's undeserving, but just because it's so hard to get in as a wide receiver.
See, but you also got to remiss if we don't mention that Harrison, with legal problems at the end of his career, was essentially retired by the Colts because he wasn't worth the possible aggravation that he was going to have. So, I mean, people forget about that because he was injured that year and he had that big, you know, that murder that happened at the club he owned or something. And, you know, that's a cloud that I'm sure hung over him that pushed him down the list to wait a couple years until that was all resolved, I'm sure.
Just to go back to Justin's point there, Jay, I have for a number of years wondered, isn't it time that the Hall of Fame committee sit down and do a 1 year bumper edition of the Hall of Fame class and round up a lot of these guys who are finding it more and more difficult to get in, you know, and I think maybe the next player on your list, the offensive tackle there from the Rams, he's one of those players, he should have been in as a first ballot Hall of Famer, and yet he's got to wait a year. I wonder if it's time we have a 1 year, maybe induct 10 to 15 players and clean up the backlog.
Well, I mean, we're going to definitely run into this problem. You're mentioning Orlando Pace, who was a definite, you know, Hall of Famer, dominated at his position of left tackle for many years with the St. Louis Rams. He also played a season with the Chicago Bears. I don't know if you can call it playing. You know, and honestly, I'm going to include Dick Stanfell here, too, who was a guard before the NFL even really existed with the Detroit Lions and the Washington Redskins. This is back in the 50s. So well before both of our times, Neil, us old timers.
Thank you. I was waiting for you to say, Neil, could you tell us what he was like in his playing days? Just to confirm I'm not that old.
So honestly, it's tough to judge the offensive linemen, right? We have this problem. We try and spend a little bit of time on our own show talking about offensive linemen. But it, you know, even what we do is very, very limited to what we can actually offer in terms of any sort of insights as to offensive line play. And I think it's difficult for these guys to get into the Hall of Fame for sure, especially on the first ballot. But both these guys are definitely outstanding. I kind of want to skip over because we're running kind of long today here. What a surprise. But Ken Stabler, the other inductee into the Hall of Fame, quarterback for the Oakland Raiders, also Houston Oilers, New Orleans Saints. But I think he's best known for his time with the Raiders. The Snake, Ken Stabler. An interesting character, to say the least, when we're talking about characters playing the game. Anybody have any thoughts or memories of Ken Stabler?
I think he may be something we're going to see quite a lot in future years. He may be getting into the Hall of Fame, and I don't at all mean to disrespect him, but he's getting into the Hall of Fame based on social media because he happened, sorry, it's going to sound terrible, but he died at the appropriate time when discussions about the Hall are there. I think social media is going to do that to us over the next decades, who knows, in terms of hyping up players who, I don't think Stabler should be a Hall of Famer. I don't think he was that great a quarterback, really, in the sense of other great quarterbacks. But I think social media pushes us in that direction now.
Hmm.
Sorry if that sounds harsh.
No. I think it's totally fine. But, he does have a very high winning percentage. He did finish a second all-time in terms of completion percentage at the time of his retirement. And I think when you're talking about a Hall of Fame, I mean, Ken Stabler is definitely one of those guys that just, you say his name, you know who he is. He was voted to 4 Pro Bowls as well and part of the all-decade team of the 70s. I think if you're part of an all-decade team, you should be in the Hall of Fame.
Agreed.
By the way, and I start this conversation knowing that we are running rather long today. Some of the guys available for the Hall of Fame next season, I think undoubtedly a number one first ballot Hall of Famer, just because we talked about him as possibly being one of the greatest running backs of all time. LaDainian Tomlinson will lead next year's first timers. Jason Taylor, Hines Ward, Brian Dawkins, and Donovan McNabb also eligible for the first time in 2017. I would say out of that group, taking LaDainian Tomlinson out of it, that Jason Taylor probably the only other one, and even that's a little bit arguable.
It's got to be Dawkins, right? He's got to be in there.
See, Justin, if you had done your research, you would know that Pennsylvania has the most is the birth state for the most number of Hall of Famers by any state. So that means Jason Taylor's a lock. So.
Of course, I forgot to check the birth certificates of all the candidates.
It's important.
I mean,
I don't see Jason Taylor as a Hall of Famer.
No. Okay.
No, like, am I the only one who thinks that Brian Dawkins is an obvious Hall of Famer here?
I think you are.
No, absolutely. No, clear Hall of Famer Dawkins. He's not maybe not first ballot, but. Certainly in the first 2 or 3 years of eligibility.
Yeah, I would have him agree with you. Just second to Tomlinson as far as who's most deserving on that list.
Yeah, I think that's a clear
the elephant. The elephant in the room here, the elephant in the room, of course, is Hines Ward. So just say, hey, Greg, Hines Ward, no chance.
And I'd say that since it's evening over there in Scotland, you're probably drunk. So.
I don't know if he has no chance, but I mean, Hines Ward is not a Hall of Famer, Greg. Come on.
Yeah, you're kind of all right because he's definitely not deserving of the Hall of Fame, but he probably will go anyway because Steelers who don't deserve seem to go in a lot. Just look at Jerome Bettis.
That's exactly right.
Well, I'm glad that we'll be having this conversation in about 4 years when Hines gets in, because right now, isn't there a backlog with also T.O. and Randy Moss waiting at wide receiver? So.
Yeah, and Reggie Wayne, all of these players, way better than Hines Ward.
Well, Reggie Wayne has to wait 4 more years to be eligible.
Oh, you know what I will say, though, is if there was a Hall of Fame for, like, crackback blocks, you'd have to put Hines Ward in there.
Oh!
Which were legal when he did them.
Oh, no, I love him. I'm all for him. Back when Golden Tate was on our team, he was terrific at him.
Who is that linebacker he flattened? The Cincinnati linebacker.
So you guys have all been tricked by Monty with your anti-Steeler bias. So you guys just got to calm down. We'll talk about the Steelers when they're eligible. You know, we didn't talk about Alan Faneca or anybody like that that's being, you know, missed this year. So
we'll yeah, I think it's...
Greg, give us the Hines Ward stats.
Well, his big number is the 1,000 catch mark, which is still rare, despite the fact that probably 6-7 guys will get in the next 5 years. But that's a big stat. And I think, in my personal opinion, I think, you know, kind of like Kenny Stabler, he gets credit for his spirit when he was playing with the smiling and all that stuff. But he was also willing to mix it up. I mean, he did, you know, he kind of played wide receiver like a tight end. So he's automatically on my top 20 all-time Steeler list. And since like 25 Steelers are in the Hall of Fame, I mean, you know, kind of defaults into.
Terrell Owens finished his career in 2010 with the second most yards, second most touchdowns, fifth most receptions amongst receivers in NFL history. Randy Moss surpassed Owens' touchdown total before retiring in 2012. I think those are two wide receivers for sure ahead of Mr. Hines Ward. So Hines has got himself a little bit of a wait. And honestly, if you have to wait that long, are you really a Hall of Famer?
Well, yeah, and I mean, those are two of the top. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's quite harsh, Jay, because you're comparing Hines Ward, who was obviously a terrific player, and I was just teasing a little bit. I think he probably will get into the Hall, but you're comparing him there to Moss and Owens, who you can stick them as two of the top three wide receivers probably of all time. So maybe a little bit harsh on Hines there with that comparison.
But also contemporaries. Hines Ward played at the same time that these two guys played. So if I'm comparing players, I got to look at that.
But at the same time, I mean, you're talking about Terrell Owens, Randy Moss, and Marvin Harrison, who all had 100 touchdowns on top of their gaudy stats. And with Randy Moss, you know, I mean, he's a once-in-a-generational talent just physically, not just the hard work that he put in and everything. And then T.O., I mean, again, he was a size speed freak that, you know, worked on his game endlessly. I mean, I'll admit that those guys are all much more worthy. I mean, the 100 touchdown mark for a receiver, that's mind-boggling. Before those guys, I think it was Jerry Rice and a guy who played in the 40s that had 100 touchdown catches. So
anyway, there's going to be a ton of articles about players that have been left out of the Hall of Fame, players coming up that will be due for the Hall of Fame, and we'll have plenty of time to talk about those all in other podcasts. But I do want to get in a quick preview here of the Hall of Fame game, which will start a whole bunch of Sundays for us, where we're going to have some football to talk about all the way into 2017. And we have, ladies and gentlemen, our first superfan battle of the 2016 season. Here we go.
Hey guys, this is Dan, the Colts superfan, and Brian, the Packers superfan, here to talk about football finally getting underway. How you doing, Brian?
I'm great. Good to hear from you, Dan.
Yeah, you too. Well, it was supposed to be the Super Bowl from last year. We get the first game of this year. So Colts and Packers were favored to play in the Super Bowl last year, and Packers' story went a little better, I guess, than the Colts' story. But
yeah, slightly.
No quarterback injury. So that was a good start to it. What do you expect to see from the Packers here as we open up our first football game of the year?
Well, I guess first and foremost, what I want to see from Green Bay is just some semblance of control over players' playing time. The last 3 years, I think two of the last 3 years, we've had some season-ending injuries in the preseason. Obviously, last year we lost Jordy Nelson. I believe 2 years ago we lost Brian Bulaga. So I'm hoping we can see our luck even out and come out of the preseason healthy despite playing five games. So that's kind of first and foremost. Other than that, I think just to highlight some of the things that I'll be watching during the the preseason here. Defensive line, especially, I think it's easily our thinnest position group after Raji retired. We did draft Kenny Clark, whom there's been a little bit of buzz about from camp, which is great because he's going to need to play an awful lot of snaps for us early. I'm anxious to see how he holds up at the nose as a rookie first-year contributor. Other than that, I'm thinking we've got quite the logjam at wide receiver, which sounds a little crazy when you consider how dysfunctional our offense looked last year, particularly the passing game. After Nelson and Cobb, we have a lot of unproven but really young players to sort out. There's really five guys for three or maybe four slots, and it'll be interesting to see how each person that's part of that secondary tier of wide receivers that we have, Davante Adams, Ty Montgomery, Jared Abradaris, Jeff Janis. We drafted Trevor Davis this year. Curious to see how they all kind of shape up throughout the preseason, who can contribute the most on offense and special teams. And then lastly, we saw inside linebacker as a position of desperate need for us the last couple of years and really hadn't really done a whole lot to address that. This year we did draft an inside linebacker, so I'll be watching Blake Martinez. He was our fourth round pick this year. He's endeared himself to a lot of the coaches throughout the offseason process, so it's time to see what he can do on the field. And also kind of along those same lines, at inside linebacker, I've read reports that Green Bay has been experimenting with Morgan Burnett as a linebacker safety hybrid a la Dayon Buchanan. So, we've really struggled in coverage from the linebacker position, and I'm curious to see if he can really help us out there. So those are just a handful of the things that I'll be watching for in this game and the next five games, really. What about you, Dan?
Well, for me, I'm really excited to see Andrew Luck back under center. It sounds like the starters are going to get some time playing. How much is yet to be communicated to us, but it'll be good to see Andrew Luck under center and see what kind of offensive line they put in front of him. That was the big story last year, was he was constantly under pressure, and the Colts went out and addressed the offensive line in their draft. They drafted four rookies, all with some considerable experience for the college level. I think they all have over 36 starts at the position, which is pretty significant. The biggest prize in the draft was the center, Ryan Kelly, and I don't know if he's going to play much. It sounds like he already has a strained shoulder, but if he doesn't play, it'll be interesting to see who they move into that center position. They have guys that are pretty versatile along the offensive line, so it'll be nice to see, I guess, how much versatility is really there. And then going to the backfield a little bit more, like I said, we'll have Andrew Luck back. And last year, Matt Hasselbeck had some significant time playing throughout the season. So it'll be interesting to see who can step up and win that backup starting quarterback job. I don't expect Frank Gore to play much. So they brought in basically a whole new stable of running backs after him. So we'll be seeing a fresh look at, I think it was Robert Turbin, Jordan Todman, and then an undrafted rookie, Josh Ferguson. It'd be interesting just to see what dynamic they bring to the game of football. And then flipping over to the defensive side of the ball, they didn't do a whole lot over there. The inside linebacker they lost was Josh Freeman. They replaced him. I think they ended up replacing him last year, bringing in some free agents and even having a trade for C.O. Moore. So I'll be interested to see really who plays the linebacker positions. And lastly, the pass rushers, it seems like everyone there is pretty old. You got Trent Cole on one side and Robert Mathis on the other. But after that, I don't know if Indy even knows who their other pass rushers are going to be this year. So it'll be nice to get some eyes on who may play the pass rusher role for Indy. And we got a whole new coaching staff outside of, what's his name, Chuck Pagano. So we've got a new offensive coordinator, a new defensive coordinator, and got a new offensive line coach that was a former offensive line coach for Green Bay, I believe, with Joe Philbin. So, I'm not expecting to see great chemistry out there between the guys on the field quite yet, but hopefully we can see some sort of chemistry growing and so that when the regular season comes, that this fifth preseason game actually pays some dividends for them and they can hit the ground running like they used to do back in the Peyton Manning days. So they have a lot to work on, I think, and hopefully this is a good first step for them.
Yeah, let me ask, do you expect to see a lot of the first string in this game? I really don't expect that we're going to, you know, maybe we get one honorary series out of Rodgers, but he really didn't play at all in the first two preseason games last year, and now we've got an extra game to play with here. So I kind of don't expect to see a lot of our key personnel in for much of this game, and maybe not even much of next week. How about you from the Colts perspective?
Yeah, I'm kind of of the same opinion. You might see the Colts starters play a series, maybe two tops, just to get them going and clicking. Have a nice little extension to training camp. But, I mean, the big key for them last year was having a healthy quarterback, so they're not going to put Luck out there with the second string offensive line by any means. But, you know, maybe two series, but probably just the one like you're suggesting that Green Bay will probably do. And, you know, the timing is going to be a lot more important for Indy to get going on, too, with the new offensive coordinator and some new pieces on the offensive line to play with.
Yeah, you guys have really kind of lost a lot of the pass catchers you've had that kind of really were a strength of your game in previous years. What do you think about the passing core you got in Indianapolis these days?
I'm pretty excited about it, to be honest. Having Luck throwing to Hilton is always exciting. Anytime you can get some speed on the field, you're going to have an exciting opportunity to score points. And they got Hilton with some speed. Dorsett, he's unproven, but he has some speed. And he ended up playing pretty well, I think, right before he got injured. And then you got the Dante Moncrief, who's shown a little bit of chemistry with Luck, but he also has some speed. So if the offensive line can give Andrew Luck some time to make some plays, I think you'll be able to find some receivers in the open that can catch and then make some plays after the catch. But are they going to be there week one of the regular season? Probably not. But, you know, this again, the fifth preseason game may help them get ready for that. We don't have the log jam, so to speak, that we used to have. So there's some opportunities there for wide receiver spots 4 and 5. And then I was on the record as not enjoying Kobe Fleener's time in Indy. It seemed like he had so many opportunities, and he would just drop the ball with no one around him. So our new offensive coordinator has a history of utilizing the tight end, so I'm hoping Dwayne Allen can stay healthy and really show us that he's worth the new contract he got this offseason.
Yeah, he always has kind of impressed me from a all-around tight end kind of aspect. He kind of brings a lot to the table there.
Yeah, definitely. And hopefully vamping up the offensive line will really let him get out into the passing game a little bit more than he has in the past. So that'll be huge for his career to be able to do that. So I think we would be doing our fans a disservice if we didn't talk a little bit about the Hall of Famers that are being inducted this weekend. Brian, you want to get us started with a little bit of talking about maybe your favorite moment with Brett Favre?
Man, there's an awful lot of them. You know, we were talking just before we started here. I've been a Packer fan since I was 5 years old. I'm about 31 years old now. And, I, you know, that year, first year I started paying attention was the year we traded for Brett. And, you know, I grew up in Green Bay, a few blocks from the stadium. So I used to go to training camp every day. And I just happened to be walking to practice, and he was also crossing the street. So it was interesting. He's new in town. Nobody really knew much about him. He didn't know what he was going to turn into. So there was only like maybe 3 or 4 people around him. And as a 5 year old, it was great to get a chance to get up close and personal with the future idol of mine. It was great. Brett was talking to the fans for quite a while. I think I can't remember if it was Steve Mariucci or Andy Reid at the time, but somebody, I wasn't paying attention who, but somebody yelled over because he was going to be late for practice. So I thought that really was just kind of summed up his personality. Very outgoing, wants to get out in front of the fans, talk your ear off type of person. So as far as off the field, I think, you know, that's one of the things that I'll always remember just kind of from my childhood. On the field, you know, we had kind of gone through the dark ages for about 30 years between the 60s when Lombardi was coaching in Green Bay and winning Super Bowls till we got to back to one with Brett. And, you know, that audible he made to to throw the deep pass to Andre Rison to really break that game open. And then you got to see his celebration afterwards. Those are some of the memories I'll always remember. And then just that iconic game on Monday Night Football against Oakland, I think the day after or maybe 2 days after he lost his dad. It was, you know, I'm not a very spiritual person, but there was something weird going on in that game. Just everything broke our way. Wide receivers coming down with passes they had no business catching in triple coverage. And, you know, it was just a sight to see. How about you, Dan? You got a couple of guys going in here, Dungy and Marvin Harrison. Got any memories from them?
Yeah, I sure do. Marvin Harrison, he's instrumental in providing Peyton Manning with a nice, reliable target to throw to. He had some very nice precision route running skills that Peyton Manning utilized, and Peyton grew some trust in him that he could, you know, throw to Marvin Harrison to where Marvin Harrison was supposed to be, and he would magically make the catch. So he had a lot of catches that were pretty outstanding in my mind. But my favorite year was the year when Peyton and Marvin were they were really gelling. I think it was the year Peyton broke the touchdown record for most touchdown passes in a season. And the two of them were just – they were having so much fun out on the field. One of the games, it ended up being a big blowout. I think Marvin had two or three touchdowns that game. And on his last touchdown, he was just running down the field, no one around him with the football in his hands. And the ref was right by the end zone, and Marvin looked like he just started running right at the ref looking for a high five, like, hey, let's have some fun with this one. So it was a pretty cool season for the Colts that year. Unfortunately, like many of them, it didn't result in a Super Bowl. But Marvin Harrison, that season, I think he set the record for most receptions, which still stands to this day, I think at 143, which is a pretty incredible season, really.
Yeah, wow, that's incredible.
So, yeah, he was instrumental in helping Peyton develop into having that reliable target that he could throw to. And then Tony Dungy came over to eventually get the Colts over the hump. He brought his Tampa 2 in and basically provided the defense for Peyton to go out, and Colts would get an early lead, and Dungy would just play his Tampa 2 defense, really let the pass rushers get after the quarterback once the Colts had an early lead. And Manning and Dungy worked some magic. I think they had quite a few fourth quarter comebacks between the two of them when they needed to. I think my memory serves me right. They were down 17 against the Buccaneers 1 year, came back fourth quarter, about 5 minutes left, came back, tied it up, and won that game in overtime. They had another game where the Colts were, I think they had 14 minutes of possession against the Dolphins the year the Dolphins ran the Wildcat, but Tony Dungy's defense kept them out of the end zone, so held Miami to the field goals, and Peyton was able to get them the victory with only 14 minutes of possession. So the wins that Tony Dungy was able to get were pretty unique for football on that day. So he was instrumental in getting them that Super Bowl win against the Chicago Bears that year too.
Yeah, so, thanks for that, by the way.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime you can beat a team quarterback by Rex Grossman, you know you're doing something right.
That's right. Well, thanks, Dan. I've got to get going here, but I wanted to wish you the best of luck. Hope your team stays healthy throughout the preseason, and I guess we'll see you in week 8.
Yeah, that'll be this is the pre-match, I guess, for that game.
Yeah. All right, take care, bud.
All right. Thanks.
All right, so there you go. That's Dan, our Colts super fan, and of course, Green Bay Brian. Who could forget Green Bay Brian? Ultimately, we just don't want to see anybody injured this Sunday, but I mean, we all know, especially with the first game of the NFL preseason, this isn't really a game that you're going to want to watch. But we're just hoping that no one gets injured. Greg, what are you going to be watching? Are you going to watch the game at all on Sunday?
Well, I think I've said here before that I'm heavily invested in my fantasy leagues in Andrew Luck. So I'll be watching until he leaves the game, hopefully fully healthy.
After one series. Justin, any thoughts on the Hall of Fame game?
Yeah, it's going to be nice to watch football. I mean, just at the end of the day, a lot of these players we're going to be watching are going to be deep roster guys, a lot of which won't even make it. But you know what? That's still better than anything else that's going to be on TV. I'm excited regardless of how unimportant this game is.
Jay, I couldn't care less. I would much rather spend the afternoon watching or researching NFL players' birth certificates.
That's well done. That is well done. Hey, Green Bay Brian has written up a preview of what you want to watch for this coming Sunday that may or may not have already been divulged to you during our preview there in the Superfan Battle. So you're going to want to check that out at facebook.com/NFU podcast, or just type Next Fan Up in the search bar on Facebook and you'll see our page. It comes right up. We'll make sure that Dan gets something written up before this Sunday comes along so that you too, that you'll be able to read exactly what you're going to want to watch for from the Colts perspective, as well as the Packers perspective. And then, of course, all season long, our super fans will be doing this. And so during the preseason, they'll be offering you up what they're going to be watching for when their preseason games are on, so that you know exactly what you should be watching for, because you're clearly not watching preseason games for the competition, because there isn't a lot of, it doesn't come down to a W or an L during this time of year. And then during the regular season, the superfans will be providing you with write-ups as to what they expect to see happen in each and every regular season game for the upcoming 2016 season. And that will all be on Facebook. You can write to us what you think is important to watch and what you would like us to talk about. nextfanup@gmail.com, just like Jared, who wants us to talk about kickers. I don't know. Are we going to talk about kickers next week, guys?
No.
Well, one of the interesting things with kickers, and maybe to do with the preseason games we're going to watch, is what happens on kickoffs with the new rules. Whether they actually do, as we discussed months ago, if they would just sort of boot the ball high up into the air and try and drop it inside the 25.
Didn't someone here have a kicker on their team that got hurt during the preseason and sort of ruined the entire rest of the season? Am I wrong about that?
It was a stumbling block. We got it over it by week 4. I mean, come on.
Kickers are people too. Kickers are people too. At NFU Podcast is where to tweet us. I mentioned the email address. Download us and share us. iTunes, Stitcher, Aha Radio, anywhere great podcasts are heard. And with that, I leave you with the immortal words of Jeff Fisher. There you have it.
Well, I think we learned today that, you know, this game is 4 quarters long.
That was a little better, but let's go back to the top and go for take 3.
Yeah, that's not happening.